co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9:01. And coming right up on Political Perspectives, Ross Freeman Levin interviews Seattle HempFest Executive Director Vivian McPeak about Washington State's process of legalizing and regulating marijuana for adults. They also discuss the history of Seattle HempFest and what the impact of this world's largest marijuana advocacy event plays in the overall movement. At 9:30, economist Richard Wolff interviews Professor Sheila D. Collins about her new book about lessons from the New Deal for today's economic crisis. Excuse me. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints. Today features updates on protests against the police killing of unarmed teen Andy Lopez and on the dire situation for children in occupied Palestine. Also, investigative reporter Robert Perry discusses his recent article, Contra Cocaine Was a Real Conspiracy. At 11 o'clock on the KBOO Bike Show, the topic today is how bike friendliness translates to business. The guest is Dr. Kelly Clifton, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Portland State University, who teaches transportation planning and policy. Thanks for listening today, everybody, and thanks to all you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one too by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now we go right to Ross Freeman Levin and HempFest.
So you're about to be listening to my interview, recorded about 2 weeks ago at the Seattle HempFest office in Seattle, Washington. I'm Ross Freeman Levin, and I had the privilege of working more than two decades ago at a little coffee shop in Seattle with the interviewee, Vivian McPeak, who is the executive director of Seattle HempFest. I want you to know that this recording and this piece are by no means an advocacy piece about the use of marijuana, but rather an invitation for people to get engaged with their local government, their state government, and be involved in the regulation of their civil rights. Thanks for listening to my interview with Vivian. This is Ross Freeman Levin for KBOO, and today I'm at HempFest Central in Seattle. I'm with Vivian McPeak, Executive Director of HempFest. So Vivian, tell me about what HempFest is, how you got to where you are, and where you see yourselves going in this evolving climate of legalizing marijuana.
Sure, Ross. I am the executive director of Seattle HempFest. We're the world's largest cannabis policy reform event taking place here in Seattle since 1991. And the purpose of HempFest is to give a megaphone to community stakeholders so they can share their ideas, strategies, and issues regarding cannabis policy reform. We've been doing this for quite a long time down on Seattle's waterfront.
So maybe you could tell me who came this year, and then who do you want to see there in 3 years?
Well, we had a pretty good lineup this year. Musically, we're excited to have Everlast came and performed with us, and Head PE and Lucero. It was really exciting having Jack Endino, who's kind of the godfather of grunge music in Seattle, who produced Nirvana and a lot of the grunge greats out of his basement. Jack Endino's Earthworm performed this year from our main stage. That was pretty cool. And for me, it was a real high point having Sean Wickham, the spokesperson for the Seattle Police Department, speak from our stage and give out the famous Doritos that they were offering to people coming to Hempfest this year. Got a lot of international media attention out of that. We had both Mayor McGinn, the mayor of Seattle, speak, and the mayor-elect, Ed Murray, who was running for mayor at the time. They both spoke from Hempfest main stage this year, which we're pretty proud to have that.
How many people came to Hempfest in the whole combined event this year? Do you have a count?
Well, yeah, the city police department estimates are about 85,000 a day, which puts us about 240,000, 250,000 people, about 250,000 over 3 days. You know, we registered about 3,000 people to vote in the last couple of years. Our voter registration crew, we really want to get more people involved. You know, we had a record low turnout for voting here in just the last election, one of our lowest ever. It's really frustrating. And, you know, we think that your vote is your ultimate political free speech. It's a muscle that you got to use and exercise. And so we encourage everybody to vote. But, you know, Hempfest down the road, who would I like to see there? I would like to see people who've been staying away because marijuana was illegal. And I think there's been quite a lot of those folks. And to come and find out that what kind of person comes to Hempfest, the same kind of people who go to Folk Life or Bumber Shoot or any event in the city of Seattle, people from all walks of life, from all age demographics, from all colors, all sexual persuasions. You know, the cool thing about cannabis is it really crosses every social strata, every age group, every financial category. There's people that have realized that cannabis is a safe and relatively therapeutic alternative to other substances if they want to change their mood or treat their symptoms and stuff like that. Our real focus at Hempfest right now is to change the federal schedule, get marijuana off the federal schedule. That's really the end game. But once that happens, we're going to look at ourselves as being a cultural celebration. Like they just had 1 million people in Germany for Oktoberfest. We don't see why Hempfest shouldn't live on after legalization as a big cultural celebration for the cannabis community.
A moment for engagement and connecting.
And even reflection and unity, because we have been an oppressed people. We've been a subculture here in America, which has been treated pretty damn poorly and by our own government. There's been a war against us on our own soil, and we're not hurting anybody except maybe a bag of potato chips or a bowl of ice cream. After 22 years of advocating for reform, it's pretty darn exciting to be at this nuts and bolts stage. We're actually duking it out and trying to figure it out.
So who are the parties involved right now in the development of the regulatory body that's going to implement the new law? Maybe you could outline the historical steps from criminalized possession or decriminalized possession to the present day.
Well, back in 1998, the Washington State voters voted in I-692, Initiative 692, which is the medical marijuana initiative, which gave qualifying patients certain rights in Washington State to use medical marijuana, to produce medical marijuana. And then, more notably, a year ago in November, I-502 was passed, along with Measure 64 in Colorado, two of the first outright legalization, statewide legalization laws to be passed in the nation. And man, that's really been a game changer in a lot of ways. A lot of things are happening.
So 502 allows possession for adults 21 and over, is that right?
Yeah, Initiative 502 allows adults 21 or over the right to possess an ounce of marijuana. They can't smoke it publicly. They have to be out of public view. The marijuana can't be publicly viewed. It doesn't allow for home grows for non-patients. But it's been pretty much an icebreaker on an international level as far as, you know, opening the dialogue and the discussion on whether it's time for the whole state to flip. In the year since I-502 has passed and Measure 64, national polling has gone up 10 points, which is a pretty significant change in just 1 year for legalization across the board nationally. So, you know, it seems like this is a discussion that America's been ready to have for quite a long time. And frankly, I can hardly keep up with all of the news reports and stories that are coming out about cannabis commerce, about you know, various reform initiatives and reform plans in other states. It's a pretty exciting time.
I know Oregon is working in a similar direction and maybe has some lessons to learn from what Washington has gone through. Like at Hempfest, and maybe you could say when it happens and sure, what it's about, and kind of what that energy of the broader community is about legalization, patient access, and long-term viability of an industrial hemp industry.
Well, you know, Seattle Hemp Fest is always the third weekend in August, right by Pier 70 at Myrtle Edwards Park and Centennial Parks down on the Seattle waterfront. And I believe that it's August 15th, 16th, and 17th next year. Hemp Fest has always advocated for three things, and that is domestic industrial production of hemp, industrial hemp here in the United States, which is currently illegal on a federal level, medical marijuana, which of course we know is also illegal on a federal level, and personal use or recreational use. We believe that adults in a free society deserve the right to make their own educated and informed choices on what they put in the sanctity and the sovereignty of their own bodies. That those choices should be made based upon truthful and accurate information, and HempFest exists really because we've heard the government's propaganda all of our lives, and now it's our turn to speak, and that's why HempFest is around, to kind of give the other side and allow people from all over the country and even sometimes other countries who are involved in the struggle to reform America's cannabis laws to come and present their ideas and strategies.
Is there a big hurdle or a roadblock right now to allow the access to commercial cannabis for adults?
I-502 put control of retail marijuana operations under the auspices of the Washington State Liquor Control Board. The Liquor Control Board has been given the job, the really complicated job, of creating the guidelines, the pricing structure, the taxing structure, the basic blueprint for retail marijuana sales in Washington State under the guidance of the state. Recently, there's been a lot of controversy within the cannabis policy reform and patient and access communities because the Washington State Liquor Control Board work group, which was put together by the governor, by the Liquor Control Board, has made some pretty startling recommendations to roll back most of the I-692 medical marijuana liberties that were voted in 1998. And what that means is they voted to get rid of home grows even for qualified patients, to roll back the amount of allowable marijuana for qualified patients from 24 ounces to 3 ounces, to remove the affirmative defense, which a medical marijuana patient would theoretically use if they were busted with an excess amount than is allowable by state, because some people have extenuating circumstances, extenuating conditions, they need to eat more marijuana or whatever. And with the affirmative defense, they could basically mount a defense, say, look, I know I had more, but here's the reason why I needed it. You know, a lot of the businesses in Washington State, just like businesses everywhere who are trying to do legitimate business in states that have legalized some form of marijuana commerce, are really trying to pay taxes, a lot of them, and having a struggle trying to open a bank account. It's very difficult. The IRS will not recognize these businesses. A lot of banks will not do business with marijuana-related businesses, even in states that have voted in as legitimate business venture. They've forced a lot of these businesses to deal in cash, which makes them extremely vulnerable to being ripped off and also to being charged with money laundering. It's kind of a catch-22 for a lot of these entrepreneurs that are trying to do legitimate business in what is clearly the new emerging market in the United States of America. I can't remember how many states have done some form of legalization, either medical marijuana or other. I think it's up to maybe 17 states or something like that now. 18 states, I forget. You know, we really need to get cannabis off the federal schedule completely as a Control 1 substance. We need to get off, not Control 2, which is pretty much the OxyContin model. Not even Control 3. You know, alcohol and tobacco were exempted from the federal schedule entirely. We know that those two substances combined kill millions of people globally every year, and marijuana is significantly safer than either one of them by every statistic you could possibly look at. So it's really time to get marijuana on the same playing field. There are a lot of ancillary industries that are also supported by the cannabis industry. And we're talking about, you know, people that make scales and containers and point of sale systems and nutrients and lighting systems and racking systems. I mean, it goes on and on and
processing
on.
Processing equipment.
Processing, that's right. There's a lot of legitimate legal businesses that are springing up that exist around this huge emerging market. Marijuana right now is only technically legal in two states for recreational use, but it's already the largest cash crop in several American states right now. Illegally, it's the largest cash crop, larger than corn or soybeans or what have you. My God, the potential, you know, once we flip prohibition, once we get Americans to have safe access to quality marijuana legally, we're going to see this be an incredible economic generator. You know, we've been told for years that marijuana is the gateway to hard drugs. Most of us have seen that science disproves that. What I think cannabis is the gateway to economic recovery for our nation in a lot of ways. And, you know, right here in Washington State, we've got hundreds of medical marijuana dispensaries operating. You know, I drive by them all the time. And here in Lake City, there's must be five or six in just the 3-mile drive from here to my house that I pass every day. I never see anybody standing in front of them. I see people driving up. They get out of the car. They go in the door. They come out. They drive off. I don't see any crime. I don't see any problems associated. They're producing jobs. Many of them are paying taxes. They're producing revenue. They're paying rent. They're buying security cameras, operating like any other business does, adding to a general revenue stream in our state and our municipalities. You know, these businesses want to go legitimate. They want to do the right thing. They want to pay not only state, but they want to pay federal taxes. They want to be able to bank. There's really no reason that the federal government should be in the way of these businesses helping to revitalize our economy, which is clearly hurting. There's several ideas that are going around. There's several bills that are being put together right now by some representatives and by some advocates, ways to kind of protect home grows, maybe protect the dispensaries, which right now are extremely vulnerable, operating in a gray area, ways to prevent perhaps a statewide registry from taking place, putting patients in potential harm's way from federal identification. You know, Ross.
Maybe you could outline that one concern just so people understand, because that's the difference between Oregon and Washington. Oregon has a registry, and we know that that database is accessed regularly by law enforcement.
This age of increased surveillance and NSA surveillance and WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden and all that, we've seen that the government has an insatiable lust for information. The federal government really wants to know everything about all of our lives. And to some people, that's a little bit alarming, that you can't always trust the government to make the best decisions, especially when you can see how they're treating marijuana and marijuana patients, putting marijuana patients, sometimes sick and dying people in jails and prisons with murderers, you know, treating us basically like we're terrorists. And that's how you can expect the federal government to approach medical marijuana patients right now, in large part. We've seen the proof.
So the Washington community of patients is fairly opposed to creating some registry like that.
Yeah, we're concerned, because should the government come in and preempt I-502, and you know, the problem is you can't legally regulate something that's illegal. And when the state has come in and regulated marijuana is federally illegal. And so theoretically, politics aside, the federal government could decide to come in and then sue in federal court and preempt I-502 entirely and seize everything, including the patient's registry, and then have access to the homes and the addresses of every medical marijuana patient in Washington state who's potentially growing marijuana, which is a federal crime, which could get them, you know, a minimum of 10 years in prison.
Lose their property.
Lose their property, lose custody of their children, become felonized, lose their homes, their money potentially. I mean, we've seen it happen to far too many people. The drug war in general has allowed authorities to ride roughshod right over our constitutional rights. And the vast majority of those constitutional atrocities have happened to marijuana folks, you know, folks with marijuana crimes. It's, for example, the only way that the United States government can use the military against U.S. citizens on U.S. soil is in a drug interdiction program. And the only time they do that is for people growing marijuana, people selling marijuana. They don't do it for meth houses. You haven't seen helicopters over meth houses of the guys drop down on ladders with guns on their back. We've seen that in various states happening to people growing marijuana, medical or otherwise. Hawaii has been a great example of the huge eradication programs going on there using U.S. military. It's an outrage, you know, and it's at a taxpayer cost of $42 billion a year. And what has the taxpayer investment got us? More people in jails and prisons per capita than any other country in the history of the world.
And a vast majority for
nonviolent drug, and the vast majority of the nonviolent drug offenses being marijuana offenses. As many as 50% of all the people in jails and prisons. It's an outrage.
So it sounds like you're advocating for a shift of industry away from the prison industrial cannabis incarceration industry to possibly an industry based on common sense of medicine, yeah. Access to medicine, recreation by adults, and industrial cannabis production for food, fuel, fiber, and medicine.
Yep, that's right. You know, what we've seen is the prison industry exploding at a time when our economy is really crumbling. And we think that that's not the right investment that America should be making. You know, if we can get prohibition out of the way, we can see an incredible amount of potential revenue to be generated just from recreational sales. And look at the pharmaceutical industry right now. We can see, looking at that, the potential of medical marijuana. My gosh, you know, it's just unbelievable potential is out there for creating commerce, creating jobs, generating tax revenues, etc. You know, prohibition came with 80, 90 years of conditioning, layer after layer of conditioning. I think those layers are going to have to come off in the same process that they went on. Legalization is a process, not an event. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. You know, for decades, the national marijuana reform community had this kumbaya unity spirit going on. Everybody got along. Everybody was very positive. And it wasn't because we all agreed on the fine points of implementation of legalization. It's because it seemed so far off in the distance, it wasn't relevant. And now it's exciting because, boy, we are duking it out. We're slugging it out. And there is division among the ranks, and there is controversy, and there is gnashing of teeth. But it's all happening because we're actually getting there, and we've seen some laws busting out. A lot of people didn't like aspects of I-502. A lot of people in the reform community had ambivalence against the way I-502 was written because they didn't agree with the 5-nanogram DUI provision. They didn't agree with the no-home grow. They didn't necessarily agree that the Washington State Liquor Control Board would be the best organization or entity to really overview marijuana retail operations. But we needed I-502 and Measure 64 to pass really bad. We needed to break the ice nationally and internationally. There's a whole new narrative happening. There's a whole new discussion. When America has force-fed a lot of these laws down other countries' throats via United Nations treaties, saying that if you want to sign this treaty, you've got to have these drug laws, you have to have these marijuana laws. America looks pretty hypocritical now in forcing that stuff when we've had two states flip, actually, and legalize recreational use of marijuana. It's really time to relook at this entire national structure and this entire global structure of basically taking police state tactics on what's really a public health issue, not a criminal justice issue. The other thing about marijuana smoking is, who's the victim? The person smoking the joint? The idea that being thrown in prison somehow is less harmful for you than being high on marijuana for 45 minutes is just ludicrous. We keep hearing that marijuana is so carcinogenic, yet nobody produces the statistics, nobody produces the patients. Where's the body count? We keep hearing all these terrible things about marijuana, but we don't hear the story. We don't hear somebody saying, I didn't mean to beat you, honey, it was the pot. And you don't see somebody who robbed a liquor store or robbed Wells Fargo to satisfy their marijuana addiction. These things don't take place. These stories don't take place. And so, you know, all of this hoopla about how dangerous marijuana is for society is mostly propaganda. If somebody wants to sit in front of their television or by their stereo after hard day's work and smoke a joint of marijuana, it's the absolute equivalent of drinking a martini or playing a game of cards or watching a football game or whatever anybody else does to relax, as long as they're in the privacy of their own home and they're not driving a car and putting somebody in jeopardy, driving a school bus or something like that, which, of course, nobody supports. Nobody in the marijuana reform industry supports young people, kids, smoking marijuana unless it's under a doctor's supervision for a legitimate medical condition or something like that. Nobody thinks that kids should smoke pot. But the reality of it is that prohibition is the one is the thing that's actually putting cannabis access in front of kids. They can buy pot in their schoolyards right now, in alleys. Yet it's actually quite a bit harder for kids to buy some tobacco or some alcohol. So that's what we've been fighting for years, is to get marijuana on the same level as alcohol and tobacco, to get it off the federal schedule, to get safe access of safe medical quality marijuana for otherwise responsible adults and also for qualifying patients. And then the other thing that's kind of ridiculous, Ross, is that, you know, here we're getting traction with medical marijuana for what, many years. We finally legalized possession of an ounce for otherwise responsible law-abiding adults. But industrial hemp, which you can't even smoke enough of to get high, is still illegal everywhere. There's a few states that have been changing that. It's still federally illegal. And until marijuana is off the federal schedule, the Controlled Substances Act, I think we're going to see hemp being lumped in with intoxicating marijuana. And it's just absurd. Think about the revenue. And we've talked about medical marijuana. We've talked about recreational marijuana. And then industrial hemp is just another entire gigantic potential revenue source of industry. Right now, hemp's being grown in Canada, in China, in Romania, and being sent to the United States,
France, the Netherlands,
every all over. Country. Yeah, well, every intelligent country that wants to be able to compete in the global marketplace is producing hemp. We need to be producing hemp right here, right now. You can build houses with it. You can make hemp milk, hemp waffles, hemp protein powder, hemp oil, you name it. Varnishes, paints, composite board, cement.
Right.
You can make almost anything out of it. It's incredibly renewable. Hemp requires almost no pesticides. Once it gets established, it's very hard to kill. It's got a super long tap root, doesn't require that much water, and it actually puts a lot of nutrients back in the soil rather than deplete them, like nitrogen, stuff like that. It's an incredibly hardy crop. And it's as American as mom's apple pie, because it was actually commerce in the 13 colonies. You could pay your taxes with hemp when we first got on this continent. And as you know, the American flag, first flag, was made out of hemp.
This is chapter and verse from Jack Herrera's The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And I have
Yes, the Hemp Bible.
Where do you see your organization in the coming years, continuing
sure.
as an advocate? And where do you see Washingtonians maybe in that role of, you know, introducing the country to a healthy system? Where might Washington be in 2 years, let's say, if they get it right?
Well, I'm hoping that in 2 years, Washington is one of the leaders in the nation as far as having a functional retail operation going on across the state. You know, there's supposed to be 300 retail marijuana stores happening in Washington State. At least that's what they're prepared to license. That's not going to happen right away because about half the municipalities already in Washington State have put moratoriums and bans on marijuana sales in their communities. And so that's something that we have yet to see how that's going to play out. I predict that once they see the other communities selling marijuana, having not a rise in youth use, not a rise in DUI arrests, but a rise in tax revenues coming into those municipalities, then I think those other towns and cities are going to switch, are going to flip when they see, you know, that this is really an economic generator and that the sky's not going to fall. I hope that what we're going to see is a vibrant, healthy medical marijuana community operating in conjunction with the retail sales, that we're going to see safe access to patients, all the medical marijuana strains still available, because we know that it's questionable whether they'll be sold in the retail outlets or not, because they won't be really allowed to mention medical marijuana or talk about medical aspects, which is one of the reasons that we feel that dispensaries are very important. And also, we hope to see a patient community network, really, that we see now in the medical marijuana access community coexisting with the retail sales. There's a lot of sense of community and support network that takes place through the medical marijuana community that it's doubtful will be available through a retail outlet operation through
stores.
That model. Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the difference of going, going to a liquor store and expecting anything other than just buying some liquor, where you go to a dispensary and there's actually a very strong patient community and a lot of networking and really a lot of mutual support going on within those communities. There's several ideas being put forth on whether it would be a voluntary thing or a mandatory registry. And a lot of people in the medical marijuana community, of course, are very concerned. It would eliminate all of the dispensaries that are operating right now, kind of in a gray area. And essentially, the idea is why couldn't the patients just go to a retail store like everybody else? And the reality is that the patient community has some complicated needs that are a little bit different from the recreational marijuana community. And, you know, most folks that I know that are involved in medical marijuana don't think that the retail stores will be a good fit for a variety of reasons. One reason is they don't exist yet. Where are they? We don't know when they're coming. The Liquor Control Board has kind of been postponing the date for making the announcements in the final game plan, blueprint, as it were.
And if it sounds like if the regulatory body that's developing the structure that's going to, you know, organize this system is already suggesting rolling back patient access significantly, both in volume and in a patient's ability to grow for themselves. It sounds like maybe that body isn't acting with advocates or with advocacy for medical marijuana patients in mind.
The state didn't hire the Washington State Liquor Control Board to advocate for patients, right? They hired them to institute a state retail operation. And I think that the guiding principle is that if that retail operation is going to be successful, it's not going to have competition from black market or a gray market, which the dispensaries really are right now, because they're not legal under I-692. They've been tolerated pretty much because I-692 was kind of poorly written and did not really deal with access and safe supply to patients. So, you know, the state probably is not wanting to have these kind of unregulated, untaxed, gray market distribution centers competing with the state retail operations. You know, most of us that are longtime reformers really feel like they should figure out a way for both of them to exist. You know, the vast majority of marijuana users in Washington State are not medical marijuana patients, don't have medical marijuana recommendations. There should be an ample amount of revenue to be generated by recreational or personal use consumers, and it would be horrible to kind of throw the patients under the bus. And really, the framers of I-502 said all along, this is not an attempt to affect medical marijuana. I-502 does not affect medical marijuana. And to their credit, this is not their fault, but it was kind of looks like it might have been a promise they were unable to keep.
Say this system is up and running, well regulated, and half the municipalities have moratoriums or bans on retail establishments being licensed?
Well, I think that they allow, based upon population density, each community a certain amount. So there won't be 300.
They're going to apportion them, I guess.
That's right. And the ones that exist will probably be doing some out-of-town business with the folks driving from the other municipalities. In other words, if Seattle has them and they don't have them in Enumclaw, I think some folks in Enumclaw are going to be driving over to Seattle once in a while.
Well, it's a pleasure to get to sit down and talk to you and find out more about, you know, what's happening right now in the moment, what you see ahead for HempFest. Maybe you could point people to websites where
Sure.
people can get information about what's really happening.
Sure. Well, anybody can go to hempfest.org at any time and you know, find out about our organization, ways to volunteer, sponsor, vend, become a member. We have an online store, hempfest.org, which has most of the merchandise here in our physical store, HempFest Central, at 12351 Lake City Way Northeast, here at 125th and Lake City in Seattle. You know, a lot of great websites for just the general drug war in general. November.org is a great website of the November Coalition, a national organization which has been advocating for families and victims of America's drug war. People interested in industrial hemp could go to the HIA.org, which is the Hemp Industries Association's website, a great organization dealing with all that kind of stuff. You know, with medical marijuana, Americans for Safe Access is a great organization which has been nationally advocating for patients' rights across the board. And, of course, there's a variety of websites like Marijuana Policy Project, MPP.org, NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, N-O-R-M-L, .org, which can link to other advocacy organizations all across the country. It's really important that people get involved in their community because that's where they really have a chance to make a difference. Thanks,
Vivian,
man.
Thank you.
All right, Ross. Thank you, bro.
Peace.
Yep.
This has been Ross Freeman Levin for KBOO. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. Up next, we hear a piece from the series Economic Update. Economist Richard Wolff interviews Professor Sheila D. Collins about her new book about lessons from the New Deal for today's economic crisis.
I want to turn now and welcome our guest. Very pleased to have with us today Professor Sheila D. Collins. Welcome.
Thank you.
She's a professor of political science emerita at William Patterson University and a former director of its graduate program in public policy and international affairs. She's also a co-founder and board member of the well-known National Jobs for All Coalition. She's authored or co-authored many books and articles, encyclopedia entries on a range of subjects, including public policy, political economy, social movements, environmental ethics, and so on. I invited her today because I want to talk about a remarkable new book just out that she co-edited with her colleague, Gertrude Goldberg. I believe it's due for release in 2014,
It's already out. This week, yeah.
Good, from Oxford University Press.
Right.
Wonderful. It's called, let me get the title correctly.
When Government Helped.
There it is. Well, thank you very much. When Government Helped, and it's really is a marvelous study of what happened in the Great Depression, what happened under the Roosevelt era, and what it implies about what is not happening today. And I want very much to get right into it and start. So let me begin by posing the basic question, at least as I see it. During the New Deal, under Roosevelt, you could describe many of the major policy initiatives, the creation of Social Security, the creation of the unemployment compensation system, the wonderful federal jobs program that put so many otherwise unemployed people to work. You could call that bottom-up economics. It's helping people at the bottom who need it the most, and thinking that if you help them, give them a job, give them an income, give them support, they will then spend that money creating more demand for goods and services. It's a bottom-up approach rather than relying on helping the banks and corporations at the top and hoping it trickles down. Okay. Tell me, is that a reasonable way to describe the situation as the difference between then and now?
Yes, absolutely. It really, because what's happening now, it's a top-down approach. All of the resources are going to bail out the people at the top end of the economic ladder, whereas the resources of the Roosevelt administration, for the most part, went to bail out the people who were really suffering from the Depression, homeowners who had been foreclosed on, as you said, unemployed workers, the poor, et cetera.
Tell me, is there some shorthand way to understand why? Why was bottom up the policy then, and why is that absent now?
Right. Well, there are actually several reasons for that, Rick. For one thing, the New Dealers had grown up in the Progressive Era, which was focused on the good that government could do in reforming society. So they had been imbued with this kind of value system. Second was Roosevelt's...
So the government, if I could interrupt, yeah. So it wasn't like in our case, I guess that's your
right.
point. It wasn't preceded by an era in which government was bad-mouthed and government
exactly.
was made the evil demon.
Right.
It was the opposite, that
yeah.
government could and would help.
Right. Okay. And at that time in history, people had very little experience of a large federal government. There was no large federal government until Roosevelt. So they had no... you know, inbuilt as much animosity as,
gotcha.
As they do today after a 40-year propaganda campaign by the right to discredit government. Secondly was Roosevelt's own concern for the forgotten man and possibly coming out of his own experience, but possibly also because of his own vulnerability as a result of having had polio. He was sensitized to the suffering of people. To an extent that our current policymakers aren't at all. thirdly, many of the New Dealers he appointed to his administration had had early experiences working in settlement houses in the urban centers, and therefore had developed a feeling for what poverty and unemployment did to people on a human level. And so they approached their work from kind of a social work perspective rather than from an economically technical perspective. They wanted to restore dignity to the worker. Which we don't hear about today. All we hear about is reviving economic growth
right.
rather than what we can do for the human being.
Right.
The third was, or fourth, I can't remember where I am in this list, was the fact that the top-down approach under Hoover had failed, obviously. We were nearly 4 years into the Depression, and people were desperate. There were militant social movements in the street demanding that the government respond to their needs in the way that there wasn't in 2008.
Right.
And so that pressure on the government, the desperate condition of people played a role. Then you had the funding for all these programs was to a large extent from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was an independent government entity which had been created by Hoover, actually. But when he used
the power,
he sent the money to banks and insurance companies like we're doing today. When Roosevelt took over, he continued the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, but used it to fund programs for the poor and unemployed.
Can I pick up on this?
Yeah.
There's something that's extraordinarily interesting to me. And that's to pick up, even though you made a list and all of them are important, clearly, and persuasive.
And there's even more.
And I'm sure there are more. But I want to pick up on one that's important for
yeah.
me. The social movements that were pushing from below and making mm-hmm. a demand, with the exception of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was that, but which came late and has not lasted a long time, at least for the moment, or is in a low ebb at this moment compared right. to what it was at the end of 2011. With accepting that, and it's an important exception, I don't mean mm-hmm. to be disrespectful to it, but with the exception of that, we don't have anything like the combined pressure of the Communist parties, the Socialist exactly. parties, and above all, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. Is that your sense also? And could you tell us a little more about the importance of that organization of the working class from below and its role in what Roosevelt did?
Right. Well, exactly. Where you have organized political parties and trained cadre who can go out into the streets and into the workplaces and know how to organize people and create the kind of propaganda and message to, that ordinary people can understand, you get much further. Now, another important part of that story, however, is that Roosevelt, unlike Hoover, refused to use police violence against the social movements. And so, and
was
unlike
that a policy, basically?
Yes, yeah. he did. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And unlike today, where the Occupy movement was severely crushed and probably from a coordinated national, you know,
certainly looked
perspective,
like it.
It looked yes. like it. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it allowed the social movements to grow and to continue to put pressure on the administration. And there was a real fear during that time. There was also were also movements of the right, the right. fascist movements. But there was a real fear at that time among the political elite that if government didn't respond, we might have either a revolution of the right or the left.
So, that was a powerful lever
powerful,
in this situation.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the things that I clearly struck you and Gertrude Goldberg, your co-editor, and also struck me is the fact that much of the focus, or at least a significant part of the focus of the programs of bottom-up helping people mm-hmm. had an environmental or ecological dimension. Tell us a little bit about what that was, because many people think that that's a new awareness, that's recent, mm-hmm. but you show in your work that it was already present there and that the notion of combating unemployment and helping the environment could be combined. How did that work out?
It's really astounding to me, Rick, that neither historians of the New Deal nor environmental historians have really picked up on that dimension of the Great Depression and New Deal, with the exception of a few. Roosevelt himself, I think he was a much greater and more modern and more prescient ecologist than Teddy Roosevelt, whom everybody sees as the environmental president. But if you read Roosevelt's speeches, it's really, he was an amazing ecological scientist in some respects. He had grown up in Hyde Park. As a boy, he had studied all the flora and fauna of the estate. He had kept careful scientific records of it. And so when he came into the presidency, as Schlesinger said, he had a visceral feeling for what was happening to the environment. And he felt it as a personal grief or a personal tragedy. We also underrate the enormity of the environmental crisis of the 1930s. In passing, we talk about the Dust Bowl, but there were many other environmental crises as well. 7/8 of the original forests had been decimated by the time the Depression arrived. 1/6 of the entire nation's topsoil was about to blow away in the Dust Bowl. Much of the wildlife had been destroyed. I mean, industrialization was really destroying the country. And so Roosevelt saw the opportunity to both employ unemployed young people by putting in and conserve and restore, save the environment by putting young people to work in the Civilian Conservation Corps that also employed, by the way, World War I veterans and Native Americans. But
what kind of things did they do? Can you give us a feeling for that?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, the CCC reforested the country. I mean, we might be in a different place today in terms of climate change and species distinction had it not been for the CCC, reforesting the country, restoring wildlife, building a truly national system of parks, county, state, local parks, and refurbishing the national park system. They taught farmers through the Soil Conservation Service how to conserve the soil, how to grow crops in an ecologically, you know,
what we nowadays
way.
Call sustainability.
Sustainable way, exactly. The TVA was another program that Roosevelt
Tennessee Valley Authority.
Tennessee Valley Authority, which basically brought an entire region of the country, parts of seven states and all of Tennessee, into the 20th century. It had really been the U.S.'s third world. A third of the population suffered from malaria, hookworm, pellagra, I mean, you name it. People were dirt poor. In the coal country, they used kerosene to heat their homes.
Really, across the board, if I'm understanding you right, Roosevelt figured out how to combine a bottom-up economic revival program with a environmentally sensitive program for ecological sustainability. It's really
exactly.
a model. So when
it's
people
really
today say they want a Green New Deal, the irony is the New Deal was green.
Right. And hardly anybody who talks about a Green New Deal refers back to this model. This is what is astounding to me.
Yes, you know? No, a very important point. This is Richard Wolff. My guest is Sheila D. Collins, co-editor of this book, which I'm here showing to those of us who can see us on television. It's a brand new book, When Government Helped, Learning from the Successes and Failures of the New Deal, just out by Oxford University Press. Let me recommend it to you as a wonderful collection of essays that will make you understand not only what happened in the last time capitalism collapsed in the United States, but give you a clear understanding of what is happening now in relationship to what could be happening and isn't happening, and that's just as important to help understand the current situation as anything else. In your book and in several of the essays, you refer to the New Deal as having gotten interrupted at the very least, if not deflected, by what you call a deficit phobia, a shift of opinion in Washington and elsewhere that the problem wasn't, as it might appear to be, people losing their homes, people without work, industries not functioning, but instead was government debt, and that had to be problem number one. Could you tell us about this, what you call deficit phobia, how it worked then, and how it shapes what is happening now?
Okay. Yeah, I think the concern about deficits was an orthodox economic kind of belief system, ideology, if you will, in the 1930s, which Roosevelt and many of his administration believed in. But Roosevelt, for a time, was willing to go into deficit financing under the threat of the emergency. Now, in 1937, there was a kind of a euphoria built that the economy was recovering, and therefore we no longer needed to engage in deficit financing. Mariner Eccles, who was the head of the Federal Reserve, thought it was not the time to stop deficit financing, but he was overruled by Henry Morgenthau, who had a really obsession about deficits that one historian attributes perhaps to his own insecurities. He wasn't an economist. He didn't really know much about the, you know, how economics works. But he really pushed Roosevelt, and Roosevelt himself, of course, you know, thought deficits were the wrong kind of policy. So in 1937, Roosevelt began to cut back on federal financing, and the economy tanked very quickly into even the figures were even stronger than the 29 crash. So Roosevelt learned from that experience, I think, that he had to quickly put money back into people's pockets, into Main Street, and did. But it didn't pick up enough to end the Depression. And it was really the experience of hyper-fiscal policy during World War II, hyper-deficit spending, that convinced, I think, Roosevelt and the members of the New Deal that we should not do this again. But of course, after the war and with Roosevelt's death, the reactionary forces of the right came back. And so we had built up, you know, over the years, the idea that, although, the, I mean, not right away, but this whole deficit phobia today, I think, is, and also, I forgot to mention that in 1937, there was also a real fear of inflation. And so they felt they had to cut back on spending. Today, you have a deficit phobia with no fear of inflation. I mean, inflation is relatively nil.
That's why I stressed at the beginning that deflation, if anything,
right, is the real problem. Right. So I think that the economic elites really want to cut federal spending for people at the bottom because they fear that that cuts into their own profits, and they don't want to, you know, have to pay higher taxes for the government to pay back their debts. I mean, it's an absolutely crazy phobia, and it's really destroying our way of life, our system, and our democracy.
I think it's a stunning thing that the very words you use, we have not seen anything other than a deficit phobia, except at the very beginning, when the economy really looked, particularly in the last half of 2008, like it was going to be a total collapse. Right. At that moment, from President Bush on to the new President Obama, both of them, and the Congress fell all over themselves to spend the money that the government didn't have, to borrow and run the huge deficits, to bail out the banks, bail out General Motors, buy the American International Group Insurance Company. Nobody then, in those heady months of desperate action, nobody worried about a deficit.
Right.
It's literally like, you know, when the cows are out of the barn, then you're going to close. Suddenly, you're concerned about a deficit when the thing is to help the mass of people. Having just finished bailing out at enormous public expense the people at the top. So the deficit phobia is a very selectively implied and applied policy.
Yes.
Okay, I want to draw you out on something that is of enormous interest to me, and I'd like your opinion about it. After World War II, as we all know, there was a systematic attack and destruction of all the forces that had pushed the bottom-up approach in the Great Depression. The communists were demonized and made into agents of a foreign power. Socialists were more or less equated with communists and tarred with the same brush. And the attack on the labor movement, starting with the Taft-Hartley bill late in the 40s and continuing to the present day, has weakened the labor movement. As everyone knows, it's been on a 50-year decline. Is it reasonable, this is really your judgment I'm interested in, is it reasonable to see the post-World War II destruction of the organization from below as a response to what was achieved by that organization during the 1930s through the New Deal? Mm-hmm. Is that a reasonable historical inference?
I think it is, absolutely. I think there's been a very conscious effort to destroy the New Deal coalition, as it's been called. Now, it really didn't start. It didn't start after World War II. It started perhaps in 1938 with the House Un-American Activities Committee and the pullback of the Southern Democrats from support of the National Labor Relations Act. But it built through from then on
through the war.
And into the, and then the next resurgence was, of course, the anti-communism of the 50s, and then the
McCarthyism,
and then the 1970s. So it was a key turning point.
Tell us about that.
Business had been active, you know, in trying to destroy labor from early on, but during the 1970s, when the deindustrialization was happening and the international economy was changing dramatically. Business saw an opportunity to, and because of the 1960s, because business had been so derided by the social movements of the 1960s, and they saw the country heading back in the direction of, you know, the New Deal, they decided to go on the offensive. And they held high-level meetings. There was a famous memo that went out, Powell memo saying that we have to get the agenda back on track, we have to promote laissez-faire, we have to discredit unionism, et cetera. And so they created all kinds of think tanks and research institutes and legal institutions to take back the ideology of the country from one that was moving in the wrong direction.
And in a sense, what we call Reaganism, or in Europe, Thatcherism, right, or neoliberalism, really right, are all parts of this process you're describing.
Yes. It was a very conscious campaign, very conscious. And in fact, I got a hold of some papers back in the 1980, right when Reagan was elected, that had been taken out of a conservative caucus briefing by a conservative member, a member of a conservative foundation who had attended this meeting. And she was so upset at what she heard going on, and which was an orchestrated campaign to target specific sectors of the population with specific kinds of propaganda campaigns, educational efforts, et cetera. She was so upset that she came back and spread this message around the liberal philanthropic community, and called it fascism. I mean, this was from a, you know, very conservative foundation member. So I think, and we've seen what's happened since, Citizens United, you know, a whole raft of sending civil rights legislation back to the states, and on and on.
So in an important way, as your book, I think, also shows, what we are living through today, both the collapse of this economic system in the manner of the Great Depression, again, I believe we currently still call it the Great Recession, because it isn't quite as bad yet as it was, but that much of what's going on now is illuminated and shown for what it means precisely by the historical exercise of your book in making a systematic comparison that can get us clear about what has to be learned from the last time it broke down.
Right. You know, Gore Vidal once said, we live in the United States of amnesia. We don't know our history, and we don't, therefore, learn from history. And so we did this book because we felt this history was so important for Americans to understand, as a way of understanding the current period.
Good.
And hopefully making changes, you know, based on that learning.
Folks, let me conclude. I want to thank Sheila Collins for coming and talking with us. Again, this is a remarkable book just out, When Government Helped, Learning from the Successes and the Failures of the New Deal. Collins and Goldberg, Oxford University Press. I really think it's a way to get depth and historical background to very much the things we do on this program. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rick, for having me.
And that was economist Richard Wolff hosting the show Economic Update with his guest Sheila D. Collins. And again, her book is When Government Helped, Learning from the Successes and Failures of the New Deal. Coming right up, it'll be Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, stay tuned for Flashpoints, featuring today updates on protests against the police killing of unarmed teen Andy Lopez and on the dire situation of children in occupied Palestine. At 11 o'clock, the KBOO Bike Show, the topic, How Bike Friendliness Translates to Business. And thanks for listening. As always, we have one little announcement, and then we're going to go to Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning in today. It's 9, almost 10 o'clock.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO Jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Community Radio is proud co-sponsor a salsa dance party to celebrate